Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
At one point I said, are you happy? And my Afghan model friend, who now spent, nearly 20 years in Germany, she looked at me and she said, Christiane, I don't think I can translate that. I said, I just asked if she's happy. She said, in Afghanistan, that is a radical question for women. A radical question for women. They don't think about their own happiness or their own right to satisfaction in any form or fashion, emotionally, sexually, or any way. She said, that would be subversive.
My guest today is Christiane Amanpour, chief international correspondent and now anchor of CNN's international nightly interview program, Amanpour, which also airs on PBS. Christiane is perhaps the most widely recognized and respected journalist working on international affairs. She is an honorary board member of the Committee to Protect Journalists and the International Women's Media Foundation. Christiane is an ambassador for press freedom and safety for UNESCO, where she has used her profile to raise awareness of key global issues in journalist rights. Christiane has earned every major journalism award, has received 9 honorary degrees, and in 2007 was awarded a CBE. She is proud to be an honorary citizen of Sarajevo. Christiane, welcome.
Thank you, Paul. It's always great to be with you.
It's lovely to have you. I'm going to start in an unusual place, and I want to talk about your docu-series, Sex and Love Around the World.
So you're going straight for the sex?
I'm going straight to the things that people care most about in the world. You said, usually when one travels around the world exploring the issue of sex, it's done through the lens of victimhood, of sexual violence, prostitution, human traffic, and porn. And then you said, we need to talk about what it means to love, what it means to be intimate, and to respect your partner in every aspect, emotionally and sexually. We need to talk about how people come together in all those aspects of part of the complete meaning of being a human.
And I stand by that, and particularly this series was done through the specific lens of myself being a woman, and the people who I interviewed mostly were women, because it is true that most of the investigation and stories about sex are always about women being abused, trafficked, prostituted, domestic violence, the whole lot. And we've done that. We've done incredible investigations on that. I think we've moved the dial. Many of my colleagues have done the same. And I did this series. It was called Sex and Love Around the World. It is on Netflix, and it was trending for a long, long time. So I'm very proud that it was actually a subject that was counterintuitive for me as a war correspondent and a take-no-prisoners kind of person, as people sort of see me, to go into the intimate zone, because I don't often do that. I don't open myself up much, and I don't have the opportunity to go to other people in a very intimate way, because I'm always sort of, trying to be on the cutting edge of bringing justice or shining a light or, combating genocidal maniacs. And so this was actually an amazing sort of breakthrough for me, and I realized how incredibly it resonated with the viewers. It aired on CNN in the United States, and then it got picked up by Netflix, which I'm really rather proud of in our Netflix society. And it brought a whole new audience, but a whole new focus on the idea that women and girls have a right to their own, not just their freedoms, but their own interior lives, to their own intimacy, to their own sexual, emotional, personal fulfillment. And we know that that is just not the case in so many parts of the world. So I was happy to do it.
And that's precisely why I wanted to start with that, because it's not the first thing that comes to mind. And we will
deal. In fact, I think a lot of people were surprised that I did it. Yeah. A lot of people at my own network were kind of surprised. Yeah. I had the great support of my late friend Anthony Bourdain. And we talked about it many years ago. I mean, it took a while to get CNN to greenlight it, but he thought it was a great idea. As soon as he thought it was a great idea, I knew it was a great idea. Because I think he is, he really understands television and the journey and how to make things relevant, not necessarily in a journalistic way, to wit, his you know, endless food programs which have brought people, you know, together around the world over food. And I want to do the same over sex and love and intimacy.
So you did 6 episodes. They were all directed by female directors from around the world. And if I've got it right, Tokyo, Berlin, New Delhi, Shanghai, Beirut, and Accra.
That's exactly right.
So was there anything about those places which some people think of sex and intimacy as a universal condition? Mm-hmm. Was there something about those places that surprised you about the women's approach to love and intimacy and sex that was markedly different?
Well, I think it is a universal condition, and I think particularly intimacy. I mean, sex is bound up in so much violence as well as pleasure. So I think, you know, the intimacy thing, though, is the breakthrough investigation. Love, intimacy, the right to feel safe and happy, the right to ask for your own fulfillment, which many girls and women just don't. It's changing, but, you know, it's pretty rigid when it comes to women. So, yes, things did surprise me. Given that it is nonetheless universal, I always remember in Berlin talking with a fantastically beautiful Afghan immigrant who was in her early 20s. And she actually was the Marianne of Germany. She was the image that Germany projected as their image of womanhood. She took over from Claudia Schiffer, the supermodel, and she was sort of Miss Germany for a long time. And she was an Afghan immigrant, and she talked to me about what it was like to be an Afghan immigrant coming, you know, from that very harsh tribal religious society into the West, and how she felt her own way forward, and how it took a long time for her not just to be a equal citizen, but also to be able to take her human rights, her intimate rights. She took me to, because, you know, Germany has been incredibly generous in bringing all these refugees in 2015. We had more than 1 million enter Germany in 2015. It was a great, great, compassionate and courageous moment from Angela Merkel. And they've integrated pretty well. There's been very little trouble, despite the propaganda and despite, you know, the political backlash. There's been very little trouble. I think it's a great success story. But she took me to a little sort of school in Berlin that was being used as a refugee camp. So this is where Syrians and Afghans mostly were being temporarily housed, taught the language, taught the rules of a democratic, equal society, so that you, Mr. Afghan religious guy, or you, Mr. Syrian Muslim, or you, Mr. whoever you are, who think that women are just second-class citizens, sorry, not in Germany. So we're just going to give you the tools of our citizenry trade. And it was actually really poignant because I met this young woman who was married. She had, I believe, 3 children at the time. She was pregnant with her 4th, and they're all squeezed in this little, you know, sort of a totally unprivate zone in this ex-classroom where they were sort of trying to close off their own bit of privacy with blankets and curtains. I mean, just to say that's how they had their intimate relations, in full view and hearing of everybody. And I asked her, this girl who didn't speak English, and my friend was translating, the model, and I said, you know, at one point I said, you know, are you happy? And my Afghan model friend, who now spent, you know, nearly 20 years in Germany, she looked at me and she said, Christiane, I don't think I can translate that. I said, I just asked if she's happy. She said, in Afghanistan, that is a radical question for women. A radical question for women. They don't think about their own happiness or their own right to satisfaction in any form or fashion, emotionally, sexually, or any way. She said, that would be subversive. That would be subversive. So yes, that shocked me.
Wow. I'm going to pivot on to talking about you're known for interviewing some of the most consequential and important figures of our time. And, you know, amongst those, you reported exclusively from the Saddam Hussein's trial. Mm-hmm. And I want you to just tell us a little bit, because so much of your life and your career circled around the conflict in Iraq, and to come full circle to from the first outbreak of hostilities to seeing someone like that, you know, finally in the dock. Mm-hmm. Take us there. Tell us what was that was like.
So I didn't cover the Iraq-Iran war, but I did cover a lot of the post-Gulf War Iraqi craziness, absolute drama every time we went there. We'd cross the frontier. Sanctions meant there were no planes from 1991 on. You know, we'd get stabbed involuntarily by a doctor who sat at the border and stabbed us in order to give us an AIDS test. Because they didn't want us. And who knew whether these needles were clean or not clean? It was really scary. Then you'd go into the hotel, the Al Rashid, and this is post-war. I was already there during the first Gulf War as well. And you'd be followed around. And because I'm half Iranian and they had this war with Iran, they looked at me as some kind of subversive agent. And when I was getting a little too fresh and honest with my reports, they'd come over and they'd say, Miss Amanpour, sorry, you're Iranian, right? And I would be quite scared because they had hanged an Iranian British journalist in the early 1980s, yes, for investigating their nuclear situation there. So I was pretty scared about that. And you'd really have to, you know, like hang on to your courage and just sort of really just try to power through this intimidation and these tactics. And I remember doing a story about Saddam Hussein, and it's just impossible to interview people there. So I would go around the town and I would, again, this is in the early 90s, and take all these images of Saddam Hussein, which were everywhere. Saddam in Arab gear, Saddam in general's gear, Saddam on a horse, Saddam, you know, astride a tiger, Saddam with a doctorate in his hand, Saddam with a stethoscope. You know, Saddam was everywhere, omnipresent. And I remember very clearly one of his henchmen calling me in and trying to intimidate me about that report. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to play really dumb. I'm just going to say, my gosh, I thought I was flattering the president. Here I am telling all these stories and showing these, you know, these pictures about him. But of course, my script was very skewering. But anyway, I managed to get through that without being jailed or thrown out. And then sort of fast forward, I guess, to the 2003 war, which, as we know, in retrospect, has been a major disaster. Yes, they're free. Yes, they have a different possibility for the future, but it at a huge price. But, you know, in a way, I have to say, I'm not sure the Iraqi people would have at the time been able to overthrow Saddam on their own. I do believe they needed outside help. It's just the planning was so bad that I believe something that could have been much more successful in the post-war period was bungled by the United States. I mean, bungled in a big way. But anyway, so Saddam, as you remember, was discovered in his spider hole and then shoved in jail. And then a year or so later, he was brought to his first arraignment in court. And I managed to worm my way into the court, which was a room that had been a mosque in one of his big palaces. And I think to this day, I will never, ever forget, because I never saw him face to face. I never interviewed him. And he was always this larger than life monster. And he was a monster. He was a tyrant, a dictator, and a monster who's pathological, mad. And I remember being the only non-pool correspondent there and getting the Americans very angry because the Iraqis let me in, the human rights people there. And I was sitting, we were all waiting, and I could hear coming into, you know, we're sitting in the courtroom, and you can hear outside the clang, clang, clang of his chains. So I knew that he was in chains. And that was quite staggering to listen to, because here was this monster now tied up. And then I just remember him being brought in and the judge asking, you know, what is your name? And he said, I am Saddam Hussein, President of the Republic of Iraq. He was not giving an inch. And he was all, you know, bearded, and he'd been given a, you know, not his own clothes, but he was wearing a white shirt and a black suit. But I saw, you know, right there and then how from one day to the next, you know, if you're not careful, you can tumble from the highest peak to the lowest trough.
And that trial, obviously, the result was pretty preordained, and he was swiftly and publicly executed, which, as a kind of human rights person, I've always thought was a tremendous mistake to have done it. But having watched the monstrosity and barbarism of him, and then seeing that switch, that swift dispatch of justice, what was your reaction to that?
Well, I was out of the country when he was actually secretly executed, with maybe some of the victors, you know, crowds there. I actually also thought it was wrong, because I think that you have to pursue the course of justice. And although he was a monster and he refused to apologize to the very end, he was jeered and spat at and totally disrespected. I use that word with a little bit of trepidation, but, you know, you're either going to have the rule of law or you're not. You know, you're either going to be a post-war, post-dictator, post-genocidal society, or you're not. And I think that that possibly was a mistake. But I know, obviously, that there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Iraqis who were killed, imprisoned, tortured, otherwise dispatched under his regime. He used chemical weapons. I was there when he went after the Kurds and the Shiites in the immediate aftermath of the first Gulf War. The United States had asked them to rise up and do their bidding and get rid of Saddam Hussein, and then they didn't support these people, so they were slaughtered in those few months after the first Gulf War. So I understand the anger. And nobody misses Saddam Hussein. I really wish I could have got to him first and at least done a final interview.
A person who you did do an interview with was Colonel Gaddafi.
Yes.
And a kind of much heralded and rather famous interview. Tell us a little bit about that encounter.
So that would have been, you know, 8 years or so after the Saddam Hussein event. That was right in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. And I guess we were all incredibly excited and heartened by the Arab Spring. And by the way, I have to say that we have lost recently the phenomenal president of Tunisia, Essebsi, who was 92 years old or so, died in office, and was the first freely elected president of Tunisia. And I say that because Tunisia was the ground zero of the Arab Spring. It was that fruit seller, Bouazizi, who set himself on fire and sparked a revolution throughout North Africa. And Essebsi, the president of Tunisia, showed what none of the other countries did. In other words, the other countries turned to violence, to radicalism, to extremism. And now Egypt, Libya, I mean, they're kind of dysfunctional. Egypt has an even tougher military regime. Libya is pretty much a, you know, failed state still. But Tunisia showed rights for women, it separated the mosque from the state, and it's still a real example. So just to say that, you know, it could have worked, it depended on who was leader. So I was very fortunate in that my history in the region, and having interviewed Gaddafi before, and also having interviewed Mubarak many times before, I got the last interviews with both Mubarak and Gaddafi. Mubarak was not on camera, but I went to see him. There are pictures of it. I got his last words. I reported them. It was an incredible moment, and I was very, very proud to have been able to do that. I shared my interview with Gaddafi with Marie Colvin, our late colleague from the Sunday Times. She and I both got this interview. And I like to think of it as a brilliant example of how women cooperate. And we didn't try to, upstage each other. We pooled our resources. But he was crazy to the very end. While Mubarak was very conscious of what had happened and said, "I've had enough, I need to go, and I'm going," Gaddafi was the opposite. He told me, and there's this great soundbite where I say, you know, your people hate you, they want you to go. And he just laughed his head off and said, "Oh, you know, they love me, my people." And so this went on. So it was a, you know, parallel reality. Again, you know, it was pretty savage the way he was dispatched. It would have been better for him to be put on trial.
So there's a nexus between Saddam and Gaddafi in some ways, and that is through the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. And he was connected to both of them in some ways, and you interviewed him post 9/11, and you know, in some ways, the legacy of having helped and enabled the Gulf War and the overthrow of Saddam on what is now, you know, clearly false pretenses is something that will live with one for a long time. But tell us about that interview with Tony Blair.
The one post 9/11? Well, that was, you know, quite different. I mean, after 9/11, my job was to go and get all the big interviews. So I got the first one with the French president, Jacques Chirac, the first one with the British prime minister, the first one with the Pakistani prime minister. And it was all about, what are you all going to do about 9/11? I mean, what happens now? You know, is there a united front? Is there a whole change in the global anti-terrorism mandate, etc.? And nobody could have known really what was going to be the end result of what happened in 9/11. I mean, you can fast forward now and you can say that, and it's controversial to say it, but I'm going to say it, I think the world overreacted. That's what I think. I think the world overreacted, and we're still paying for it in the demonization of Muslims, in the rise of extremism and militants, in the demonization of refugees. I think that perhaps soon there'll be a little bit of a course correction, but I think that 9/11 made certain people a little bit mad. And I think it was absolutely correct to go into Afghanistan and turn out the Taliban and defeat Al-Qaeda, because that's where they hatched this despicable plot to attack the United States. I think that was absolutely right. Everybody knows to this day that morphing that into a war of opportunity in Iraq was the wrong thing to do. Having said that, I believe if you wanted to have a free Iraq, I think you still needed outside help to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but not on false pretexts, because now that colors everything, and that's affected everything that followed. I genuinely believe that the war was very swift. It took 3 weeks flat. The British, the Americans, and others up, and I followed them up through Kuwait, up all the way to Baghdad. It was like immediate. It just and because the Americans and the Brits, particularly the Americans, had told the Iraqi military, lay down your arms, do not confront us, and you will be part of post-war Iraq. Well, that was the first lie, because they were all cashiered. And who are they now? They are ISIS, Al-Qaeda, AQIM. They are those people. So I think that had there not been such an arrogant and ignorant post-war package, it could have turned out much better. I do believe that. I mean, look, Tony Blair and then Bill Clinton in the 90s intervened in, well, first Bill Clinton in Bosnia and turned a genocide around and brought a peace process with Dayton. The two of them in Kosovo, it was a preventative humanitarian intervention, and it worked. Kosovo is independent and free. Tony Blair in Sierra Leone ended that war there. It worked. Sierra Leone is free and democratic. Many problems, but nonetheless. So it can work. It's just this one was really badly conceived from the outset, and there were nefarious reasons for going in, and a completely, I mean, I don't even know what to say, dysfunctional post-war solution, which wasn't a solution.
When you sit down and think about your show, in some ways you kind of set a global conversation from your show, what are the stories at a global level that you're always trying to cover that you think right now need to be on the agenda?
Well, so I've always, because my career has been in war, famine, disaster, refugees. I mean, look, let's just take, and it's literally just come into my head, Ilhan Omar, the much maligned congresswoman from Minnesota who was born in Somalia. I covered the Somali famine and I covered the warlord fight. I was there, not at, but around immediately in the aftermath of Black Hawk Down, in those markets, know those warlords and the terrible, terrible, precarious situation. I've seen Somali refugees who've been shunted off to camps, refugee camps in Kenya, and it's been a very, very difficult life for them. The notion that somebody like Ilhan Omar is not thrilled to be an American is ridiculous, because of course she is. So I feel that on the agenda today, refugees and their real rights, a proper global response to refugees. And by the way, could we all do our bit? Could we all share? Does it have to be Angela Merkel of Germany who takes in a million and nobody else takes in practically 1,000 here or there? We need to be able to be global citizens. And if you know, the right of refugees is a right under international law, and we are, I think now it's somewhere, you'll probably know better than me, but it's somewhere around 70 plus million refugees around the world. It keeps getting the highest ever since, you know, I mean, it's the highest number of refugees in our counting database. So refugees, immigration, I think I've always been in that space which tries to see tolerance and the story of the other in the midst of the most extreme conflicts, whether it's religious conflicts, whether it's ethnic, which was all tied up in religion, and that's kind of where I am. But I would say Bosnia was my most important work for many, many reasons that we can discuss. But I think now I would say none of this matters a hill of beans unless we put the climate and decelerating our movement towards Armageddon top of our agenda. And so that people understand, it's not the world that's going to end, it's our civilization. Because the world will do very well without us, because we have polluted the world. And I think that young people are really, really, really teaching us all a lesson. They have come out, you know, all this rubbish about how millennials don't care, don't vote, don't nothing. You know, they're the biggest voting group now in the United States for the 2020 election. They're taking over the baby boomers. And they have issues on their minds. Climate being top, healthcare, you know, inequality. Those are the issues that we need to talk about.
A recent survey showed that 26 of 28 European nations, people between the ages of 15 and 30, regard climate as the top priority, ahead of health, ahead of jobs, ahead of inequality, climate. So you're absolutely right.
And it showed in the European elections, absolutely, and in the midterm elections in the US.
So I'm told that you don't put climate deniers on your show.
I don't.
Tell me why.
Because I learned very early on that you don't create false equivalences when there are none, either factually or morally. And I learned that in Bosnia when I actually was criticized and attacked in some quarters for writing the truth about the victims. And the victims were mostly the Muslim citizens of Sarajevo and the other towns that were under siege and shelling, because it was designed as a white nationalist project to ethnically cleanse, aka genocide, a certain group in order for them to be able to have a clean territory. That's basically what it was. And it took me a while to figure that out, but I could see what was happening in front of my eyes, and I was there for years. And so I reported as it was, and I got rather criticized for taking the side of, or, you know, being pro-Muslim, whatever the hell that meant. I was pro-truth. And the truth followed certain facts. And, you know, I'm proud to say that finally, you know, when that truth became unbearable for our democracies to continue to tolerate after massacres at Srebrenica and all the other places that have become, you know, infamous in our modern history, they got it. The world got it. All of us colleagues who were there from all sorts of different organizations told this story, you know, day in and day out for years. And finally, you know, with very little trouble, the United States and the rest intervened and pushed back the bullies within a week, not even, within a few days. So, you know, so why do I not put deniers on the air? Because they lie. And the science is clear. And I'm rooted in facts and evidence and reality. And I think that's the only place for reporters to be right now. There's so much fakery going on. There's so much propaganda. There's so much manipulation that you have to draw a line. And yes, maybe in the early days when we first did climate, we'd do a little bit of, you know, some crazy Björn Lomborg or whoever the Swede guy is, who always had these Wall Street Journal op-eds on why we are not in any peril, and why we're all making it up and it's all fake news. Well, we can see that it's not. And I don't see any currency to be gained in terms of protecting or helping to advance the survival of our species by muddying the waters with liars, because now the time is to see the truth and act on the truth.
I wonder if you think part of what I think we have to do with climate is cause people to run around like headless chickens in a state of deep panic to accentuate the nature and the gravity of the crisis. On the other hand, you have to show that there's solutions and there are positive paths that people can take. And when you wake up and try and say, am I going to scare people today or show them hope today? And, you know, that must be a balance in not just climate and human rights and in refugees. And all the stories that you tell are this delicate balance between hope and fear. How do you get that right?
Well, I think it's, again, it's a continuum. I think when you first see these problems, whether it's genocide or climate change, you already yourself are panicked and afraid. So your reporting reflects what you're seeing on the ground and what you're absorbing from that. And I think for sure, and the apotheosis of that was Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. And I think that was 100% necessary. I think now, less panic, more urgency, more facts, and more solutions, and more encouraging, you know, the very people who object to the notion that we're causing climate change, encouraging them to understand that this does not mean a wholesale, you know, rejection of lifestyle. It doesn't mean a wholesale rejection of what it means to be American or British or African or Indian or whatever it is. It means grabbing the opportunity to realign our economies, to realign our social and other habits in order to protect our futures. And since humans have, since, you know, the dawn of civilization, have managed to, you know, humans have managed to protect themselves and innovate their way out of all sorts of crises. To me, it's completely crazy to think that they can't out of this one. You know, I worked for the greatest American possible, and his name's Ted Turner. When he founded CNN, he created not just a media revolution, but he brought into the media the idea that that you have to protect your world. He was conservation before there was conservation. He was tolerance between people before that was fashionable. You know, he was a great humanitarian. Nuclear weapons, the whole lot. I mean, he was really somebody unbelievably prescient. And he said to me, when I asked him, what would you say to a young person who wanted to be like you, make their first $1 billion, Ted? And just a year or so ago, he said to me, I would tell them to go into green technology. So the hope and the possibility and the tools are out there. And I think our young people are telling us right now, you know, at the ballot box, and the polls are moving in their direction, that it's time now before it's too late.
I want to talk a little bit about fake news.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me if that you place social media in the hands of intelligence agencies and demagogues, you can weaponize disinformation.
Yeah.
And the weaponizing of disinformation can shift elections, alter elections, and can cause mass atrocity.
Yeah.
And so let's just start with the phenomenon of fake news, mm-hmm. that this is something that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
How you think about that, how you deal with it, and how we're going to root it out, because it's clearly a prevalent cancer in our midst.
So I would direct everybody, if they haven't already seen it, to the new Netflix film documentary called The Great Hack, done by the wonderful Karim Amer and Jehan Nujaim. Really a great film, and it lays out all these perils in forensic detail, and it's got more information and more interviews about how precisely many people are, you know, swerved off the beaten track of truth and swerved into the sphere of propaganda, lies, and manipulation. So I think that's a really good primer or primer, whatever you say, for people to get rooted in. And then I would say there is such a thing as fake news. It's called lies. Lies have been part of any leader or any person's strategy since time immemorial. Propaganda is another word for it. The reason it's so dramatic now is because it's, as you said, weaponized by the exponential delivery of these lies and this propaganda and this weapon on social media. And because there are far fewer gatekeepers, far less parameters. And therefore, the burden of I don't know, guarding the truth falls on, I think, a few individuals and a few companies that have a track record of being mainstream has become a dirty word. I don't think it's a dirty word. I think mainstream is good. It's neither on that extreme or that extreme. It's just mainstream. And we give you the facts and you can trust us. We are a brand that you know and you can trust. So whatever you see out there, whatever you see online, come and check it with us. Go on CNN.com, go on PBS, go on the New York Times, go on The Guardian, go on all these places which have proven track records, Channel 4, all the rest of it, of investigating and being able to guard the truth and project the truth. I've said several times that I do believe it is up to individuals to guard their own truthometer. Because, yeah, you can listen or watch or click on all this clickbait stuff, that it's your responsibility in the end to figure out how to use this technology. Because we've tried, we can't rein in the Facebook types. Yes, we've managed to kill off Cambridge Analytica, but who knows where they're going to pop up next. And they do have, obviously, with the great help of experts in the field, the Russians, really brilliant. I mean, my favorite story is about General Gerasimov, who's in charge of their war by other means, and their little green men who went into Ukraine, and their, no, these are not our tanks, they're somebody else's. I mean, they do it in a brilliant way, the Russians, and they have been doing it for decades. So all of that we have to guard against by going to trusted sources. How difficult can it be?
Well, I guess the question is maybe I think that trusted sources, journalists such as yourselves and trusted broadcasts and networks and public broadcasters are essential. But isn't there a regulation?
Yes.
That, yeah.
Yes.
And shouldn't, aren't we past time?
Yes.
Where certain, particularly I would say Facebook, but others as well, can no longer claim just to be the conveyors,
yes,
of news. They're in some ways
publishers.
They're publishers.
Yeah, they're journalists.
And if you're a publisher and you are responsible for disinformation which can shift elections or lead to mass atrocity, at some point there has to be accountability. And yet, there's also the human rights lawyer in me which says I'm worried about the freedom of speech implications of regulating. But the balance, the pendulum is in the wrong direction. So let's swing it back.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to give some thought of how you balance freedom of speech with accountability for facts which have real negative world consequences at this moment.
Well, first and foremost, I agree with you that the deregulation and the idea of the Wild West that masquerades as freedom of information and all the rest of it, in some cases, should be reined in, because there used to be things called the fairness doctrine, the, you know, equal time proposition. In the 80s, all of this was deregulated, and it created, in America anyway, here there's Ofcom in the UK, and their regulations in Europe. But in America, which is the prime giver of all of this Wild Westness, masquerading as freedom, there is a deregulation mania. And that has brought us to this point. Now, some of technology obviously is massively helpful. I mean, nobody would argue against that. But I do think, and the heads of Facebook, Google, all the others, are not ready to call themselves media platforms. They're just not ready to do it, no matter how much, you know, each time anybody has the opportunity to interview them, they just won't go there. So I think that there does need to be some regulation. And I don't understand why that's a stretch, because we, in the mainstream, you know, world, we have regulations. There's certain things we can't say on air. There's certain, you know, equal, you know, the fairness doctrine. You know, you have to, if you interview one side, sometimes you have to interview the other side in an election, for instance. I mean, we operate under rules. We can't just transmit lies. So why do we have to abide by those and they don't? So yeah, there's something is out of whack, and until society can figure out how to bring that into, you know, the responsible sector, we're going to be in trouble.
I always thought by 2019 we would have fewer journalists in jail and fewer journalists targeted for speaking out, that there was some sense that human history was advancing. But alas, I think the statistics are moving in the opposite direction, that, you know, we have thousands of journalists imprisoned, that, you know, Turkey and Egypt are places where it's very dangerous to be a journalist. But also in the West, you find that journalists don't find sanctuary nevertheless. Why is it that you think that journalists are back on the front lines in terms of victimization and targeting?
I think it's always been that, and it just gets worse and worse. I remember Bosnia being, I was told, it was the first place where journalists were deliberately targeted. All the people who I used to look up to and want to emulate and follow who had done Vietnam or the Central American Wars or Beirut and all those other things, they were mostly caught in the crossfire. I mean, there was a spate of kidnappings in Beirut, that's true, but in terms of people being killed or wounded, mostly caught in the crossfire with the sure knowledge that they were welcomed by all sides because they were able to tell all sides' story. And then I wonder whether it has something to do with satellite television. You know, again, big, and I'm talking about the early 90s now in Bosnia, and now the internet and social media and all the rest of it. Everybody can see what exactly you're doing in real time in their backyard. So we're out there telling the world that, I don't know, genocide in Rwanda is happening and the militants can see us, so they come after us. Or we're out there in Iraq talking about the horrors of, you know, the ISIS or AQIM, whoever they were before, and they can see us, so they come after us. Or the evil governments can see us, so they come after us. I think they have started again just to want to shut down the story. So the way to shut down the story is through intimidation, and if not intimidation, then arrest and imprisonment, and then if not that, you know, injury and death. And this is what's happening, and it's a mark of how effective I think journalism is in trying to hold power accountable. But it's also a mark, as you rightly point out, of how dangerous it still is to be a journalist. And that's why I think it's incredibly important that in the West, where there are First Amendments and all sorts of other constitutional and non-constitutional protections for free speech and journalism, our leaders need to amp up their defense of a free and independent press instead of degrade it and denigrate us. Because when a Trump or whoever, you know, criticizes the free press in the West, it gives all the other Putins and the rest of them perfect cover to attack us. I mean, come on, look at Jamal Khashoggi, and we have not even had the President of the United States agree that the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince, you know, despite his own intelligence units, most likely ordered that. And just think about it. It is actually worth saying again, this man, who was a patriot, was lured into their consulate under false pretenses in Turkey, in Istanbul. And there, he was killed. And then he was cut up, chopped up, and we still don't know what happened to his body. I mean, just think about that. Just every listener, just think about that. In 2018, a journalist working for an American newspaper was chopped up with a bone saw, done no doubt at the instigation of one of the West's chief allies. This is bananas. It's just it's impossible even to compute.
One of the most brilliant pieces of journalism I think I've seen you do is the very difficult interview, at least for him, that I think you recently did with the Saudi foreign minister, in which you read out to him transcripts of the murdering of Khashoggi in that consulate. And watching, for me, that was an exemplification of speaking truth to power. Just forcing him to confront the horror of something that was done, almost certainly at the behest of his boss.
Well, it was pretty hard actually, because I have a long relationship with Adel Al Jubeir, and it goes all the way back to when he was the Saudi press Sherpa for all of us who landed, you know, all these Western journalists in Dhahran before the Gulf War, because Saudi Arabia was the base for the American buildup and the international buildup. So I go back a long way with Adel. I consider him a friend. And yet he's foreign minister of this particular state. And I knew in the 10 minutes or so that I had with him that I was not going to get him to speak against his boss or admit something that had happened. So I thought the only thing I can do is read out Jamal's last testimony and the panic and the fear and the terror that he was enduring as members of the Saudi state were chopping him up and killing him. And I know it had an effect on Adel.
I want to talk about a story which it's not really underreported, but I think the figures still astonish me. And that is what I think can only be described as the internment of Uyghurs in China. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at the numbers, it could be as many as 1 million people in the world's second largest economy and a geopolitical colossus are now in some form of arrest. They have their freedom deprived of them. And I think one of the things that astonishes me is that there's so little coverage or defense from Muslim nations coming to the rescue of a group of people who had been targeted for many reasons, not least their religion. I know you cover this, but tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, it is surprising, as you mentioned, that the Muslim countries don't come to their defense. And I remember it was very different in Bosnia, where the Muslim population was being attacked, and the Muslim countries of the world came to their defense and helped them materially and politically and at the United Nations and elsewhere. So the difference is huge. You know, you've got the post 9/11 world where Muslims have been demonized, and every country seems to have a carte blanche to say these are terrorists. But of course, in China, it's got the added layer of complication in that, you know, what is it, 1.2 or 3 billion people there, and they want everybody to sing from the same tune. These are communists. This is a communist nation. And they have put these people, as far as we can tell, and CNN has done some exceptional reporting and has gone up there and has tried to confront officials as much as they could, has tried to see these internment camps. And has done some very, very strong reporting, which I featured on my program. You know, we're hearing all these words, internment camps, re-education, punishment, you know, making them switch religions and language and all the rest of it. Look, in the end, this stuff doesn't work. In the end, it doesn't matter if it takes 1 month, 1 year, 10 years, a generation. In the end, it comes back to bite them in the ass, and it will. It will. Just right now, for instance, the continued fight in Yemen, the United States providing the weaponry that drops onto weddings and hospitals and schools. There, the kids are growing up knowing that American weapons are slaughtering them. What is that going to do? What kind of recruitment and backlash is that going to have in 5, 10, 15 years? And you can say that in all these places. So as brutal and barbaric as these policies are, they're also dumb.
So I'm going to begin to wrap up. And one of the things that I see you as is one of the most important truth tellers of our time. And what we need is hundreds and thousands of you for citizens to rise up and to begin to be truth tellers. And I think the one thing about the changing nature of media is that we have an opportunity for a new generation of truth tellers to be born and to build a career. So somebody who's listening to the show and is trying to figure out how they become, if not the next Christian Amanpour, take their place alongside your generation of people who have been truth tellers, what should they do?
Well, first of all, I would dispute that you need hundreds of thousands. I mean, most people think I'm a big pain in the ass, and when they see me coming, they would rather slam the door on me than open it. But I do think truth tellers are vital component of our society in every single form or fashion, not even just in journalism, but in the corporate world, in the academic world, in the scientific world, because I mean, we call them whistleblowers, whatever, but people, the Me Too, you know, in the rights of women, children, all the rest of it. It's only the truth tellers who dare go against often their own tribes who make a difference. And so partly it's a war with enemies of truth, but also it's a war within, with your own tribe, and that's sometimes the most difficult. I think I would say that I'm going to misquote, but sort of paraphrase Robert Kennedy, who said in South Africa, and you probably remember it, that, not remember it, but know of it, moral courage is perhaps the strongest form of courage that you can exhibit, because that is when you start, you know, having people descend upon you and attack you, when you stand up for the truth and what's right and fairness and justice and freedom. And I just think that that's, I think I've told young people in various university commencement addresses that I've given that they don't know where or they don't know when, but one day they're going to be tested and they're not going to expect it, and it might not even be, you know, in a place they expected to come from. But that's when they will have to make their decisions on, do they stand up for what's right or do what's expedient? And I just always hope that each and everybody, no matter where they are today, when that moment comes, will make the right decision.
What gives you hope?
Our young people does, because I am really quite energized by the fact that people are coming out, boys, girls, my son's generation, their thought processes, their tolerance, their sense of urgency on some of these issues that maybe we've got, you know, somewhat tired about: income inequality, climate justice, human rights, all those things. I think that that's what really gives me hope. Plus, I'm an eternally optimistic person, so I always have hope, and I see fun, happiness in games wherever I go. You know, I blue sky, I'm yours. You know, sun, I'm happy. Whatever it is, a nice dinner at your house is great.
What a lovely note upon which to end. Christian Amanpour, for everything that you do, have done, and will continue to do, we are enormously grateful.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.